Good afternoon, everyone. This is Dr. Morgan Sammons, Executive Officer of the National Register. Welcome to today's webinar. Before we get started, I'd like to welcome my co-moderator for today's presentation, Dr. Jana Martin. Dr. Martin is the CEO of the Trust, the nation's leading provider of professional liability insurance for psychologists. The Register and the Trust recently formed a partnership to deliver high-quality educational content to psychologists, and this webinar is the first of what we hope will be many successful collaborations. Today's presentation is titled, Complying with Subpoenas and Court Orders While Minimizing Your Risk. Our featured presenter is Dr. Amanda Zelahusky, a clinical and forensic psychologist, attorney, and member of the Trust's risk management team. Before we introduce Dr. Zelahusky, I'm going to briefly cover two important guidelines. First, to submit a question during the presentation, open the icon marked Q&A in the menu at the top of your screen. At the end of the presentation, we will select a few of these questions to address. Due to time constraints, we will not be able to address every question asked. Also, Dr. Zelahusky will be unable to provide advice regarding any specific case or jurisdiction. Without further ado, I'm happy to turn it over to Dr. Martin.
I'm very excited to introduce our featured speaker. Dr. Zelahusky is a licensed clinical and forensic psychologist and attorney. She received her bachelor's degree from the University of Notre Dame, her master's and PhD from Drexel University, and her JD from Villanova University School of Law. She is board certified in clinical child and adolescent psychology. She is currently an assistant professor of psychology at Valparaiso University, where she also serves as coordinator of the dual degree graduate programs in law and psychology. Amanda, as was mentioned before, is also a member of our risk management team at the Trust. As many of you know, a significant benefit of being a Trust policyholder is access to free, confidential consultation from our risk management consultants. Dr. Zelahusky is one of seven experts with clinical and extensive legal training who are on the Trust risk management team and provide guidance on a number of issues such as today's topic, subpoenas. I know you will enjoy Dr. Zelahusky's presentation. Amanda, please share your thoughts with us.
Many thanks to both Dr. Martin and Dr. Sammons. It's definitely my privilege to be here and to represent our Trust risk management team. So without further ado, let's kick this off. I just want to note before we get started and dive in that the information I'm going to present to you over the next hour in this webinar is not intended to provide legal advice or to substitute for the advice of your own attorney. This webinar will review situations in which practitioners get requests for information for various legal purposes, including in the form of subpoenas and court orders. The sometimes conflicting ethical and legal obligations of protecting client confidentiality or asserting privilege and also complying with the law will be discussed, along with some strategies for responding to these types of records requests in ways that can minimize your risk. So I want to start from our place of fear. When we receive legal or official sounding requests for information about our clients, it can cause us a great deal of anxiety. You may not have received extensive training in graduate school or in your clinical training about how to handle these requests, so it's understandable that it can be scary. One of the reasons that it is that the demands of the legal system sometimes come into direct conflict with our primary responsibility to our clients and our duty to maintain confidentiality of client information and records. There are situations where attorneys challenge the confidentiality of this clinician-client relationship in order to further their case in legal proceedings. So it's become much more common then for mental health professionals to be pulled into legal matters in a variety of ways. Sooner or later, most mental health professionals are likely to receive a subpoena requesting client records, or at the very least, a formal records request of some sort. This tends to cause us a certain amount of panic, which can result in clinicians either ignoring the subpoena altogether or immediately providing all of the requested records or information. Another piece of this is that the requests often include intimidating legal language. So things like statements that you are hereby ordered and then a whole list of things you have to do, or failure to comply will result in, and then a whole list of pretty scary sounding sanctions. So that's another piece. And yet another aspect of this is the lack of control. So it's disconcerting to be dragged into a legal matter, in many cases against our will, particularly because our involvement inherently brings with it some elements of risk for us. Sometimes receiving a subpoena can feel sort of like a catch-22. So refusal to comply with a subpoena without valid exception is considered contempt of court, with possible punishments including fines or incarceration and possibly attorney's fees. On the other hand, if you disclose a client's confidential information without proper authorization from the client or court order, you're placing yourself at risk of a licensing board complaint, malpractice lawsuit, and potentially other penalties or sanctions. So these are many of the reasons that these requests can feel intimidating to us. So in terms of when we see this typically come up, requests for information, either formal or informal, can happen in all sorts of situations. When we're talking about formal legal demands for information, they can come up in civil cases, criminal cases, administrative proceedings, which are like licensing board hearings. Most of the time, they come up in civil cases, unless you're doing specific forensic assessment work. So you see some examples there on the slide of common situations where these requests tend to emerge. There are also several other reasons you might receive a request for records from clients. So for example, the client's personal use, they might need it to, you know, for some other purpose or to show to somebody, or they're just interested in seeing, you know, what's been recorded about them. Or there are other sort of formal settings like education or employment settings where accommodations might be being requested that a client might request their records. So another question that often comes up for clinicians is, how did I get dragged into this? So I want to just talk through some basic legal process for a second to give you some context for these requests. A basic tenet of our legal process is that in adversarial proceedings, it's necessary for all parties to have access to information that has relevance to the case. The process of discovery allows each side to get information from the other side prior to trial. If the information obtained during the discovery process meets evidentiary requirements, then it's then presented to the parties or the judge or jury to assist in deciding the case. So when I say evidentiary requirements, that could include things like, is it relevant to the case? How reliable is the information? One of the things that happens during this discovery period is that parties can get records from relevant providers, they can interview people in depositions, they can require us to testify, and sometimes they'll send what are called interrogatories, which are lengthy written questionnaires that the individual has to provide written responses to. So subpoenas then are a way to force people to provide information that has been determined to be necessary for making decisions about the central issues that the court must decide. Throughout these different stages in a legal matter, so again, whether that's pretrial discovery or the actual trial, clinicians can become involved in clients' cases that seem to have nothing to do with the clinician or the work that you've been doing with the client, because it's presumed that you have some information that is relevant to the case. Before we dive into then the specific legal requests you might get, I want to briefly just provide some clarifications and distinctions. Particularly, I want to highlight the important differences between privacy, confidentiality, and privilege, as we often hear clinicians incorrectly using these terms interchangeably. So let's start with privacy. Privacy is a legal right with its roots in the Constitution. This is an individual's right to control who has access to information about oneself. It's our right to choose what people know and do not know about us. So privacy applies to the person. Confidentiality, then, is an ethical obligation. It's an extension of privacy, and it's part of our contractual obligation with the client. So it's a key component of the agreement that we enter into with a client, whether that's oral, written, or implied. And we are agreeing to keep their information confidential, things that they reveal to us. It's our duty to protect confidentiality, and that applies to the data or information that the client is providing. Okay, so confidentiality applies to data and information. It's embedded in our ethics codes, in many state laws, but also in the HIPAA privacy rule. Now, confidentiality is often legally protected in many states, but as you well know, there are limits to confidentiality, which we also know is really important to convey to clients at the outset. Typically, we're doing that during the informed consent process. So privilege, then, is a legal concept related to the principle of confidentiality. Where privilege is recognized, information that we gain during the course of a certain type of professional relationship, like a therapist-client relationship, is protected from having to be disclosed in court or other legal processes. Essentially, the desire of society to encourage truthfulness and candor in these special relationships is why they are afforded a privilege. The privilege belongs to the client, and only that client can release the clinician to disclose the private information. When we assert privilege, which we'll talk about in a bit, we are doing so on behalf of the client, because it is the client's privilege to either protect or waive. Clinicians can't demand confidentiality or privilege in most cases if the client has agreed to disclosure. So then finally, perhaps the most important distinction I want to impress upon you today is that subpoena is not the same as a court order in most cases. It's merely a formal legal request, but it's one that has some teeth behind it. And if there are no applicable exceptions like privilege, then the individual who has been subpoenaed is likely required to provide the requested information. So now we'll break this down a little bit further. Let's review the types of information requests you may receive. So first is a records request. This is when someone contacts you, so maybe an attorney or a client's family member, to request the client's records or to ask you for information about the client. So just to briefly address this particular type of request, you would need a written release from the client for any type of records request, whether that's formal or informal. And in most cases, you can't even acknowledge knowing the client when you receive this type of request from a third party without a release from that client allowing you to do so. Now, if the request comes from the client, then you want to get that in writing and document in the chart the fact that you provided records to the client. You always want to keep track of when client information has left your office, even if it was provided directly to the client. The next type of information request is that dreaded subpoena. So subpoena literally translates to under penalty, and there are several types of subpoenas. The first is a subpoena ducis tecum. This is Latin for under penalty, you shall bring with you. This is a legal command to appear or produce specific documents or both. And then the other category is a subpoena ad testificandum. And this is Latin for to testify under penalty. And there are two types of subpoenas that fall under this category. So the deposition subpoena. We talked a minute ago about what a deposition is and its purpose in the discovery process. This is a legal command that requires a person who is not a party to a lawsuit to provide copies of business records and or to appear at a deposition to answer questions asked by one party in a lawsuit. Now, this differs from the subpoena ducis tecum in that the documents and testimony requested are part of the discovery process before trial and may or may not be used in an actual court hearing. Depositions also, just for your information, usually take place somewhere other than the courtroom, like at the attorney's office. The other type under this category is a witness subpoena. Now, this is a legal command requiring a person to appear in court on a certain date and to testify as a witness, usually in a trial. One thing that's important to note here is that unless records are specified in the subpoena, the witness should not bring what is not demanded, because that can open you up to some more risk. Finally, then, we have a court order. Now, a court order is signed by a judge, not the judge's clerk or an attorney. And it can be somewhat confusing to distinguish between those things on these different forms. So if you are not sure whether the document is a court order, You can contact the court that issued the document and ask to speak to the judge's clerk to clarify. And just one other thing to note there, the first subpoena that you receive in a matter is rarely a court order. So just keep that on your radar. Now I want to go back in time for just a minute and talk through some things you can do to minimize your risk before you receive a subpoena or a records request. It's important to include specific language in your initial agreement to cover these types of legal matters that can arise during the course of your work with a client. Doing so at the front end can avoid a lot of headaches for you down the road. Here are some examples of topics you'll want to address in your treatment contract or informed consent process with new clients. You'll want to address how you'll handle requests for information, either from the client or from third parties. This could include a statement that you require such requests in writing with appropriate releases signed in order to provide information to third parties. You should also address your policies related to involvement in clients' legal matters altogether. And you should address any associated fees so that the prospective client has an opportunity to review these policies before agreeing to move forward with the professional relationship. Just a note about fees related to legal requests for information. Typically, the subpoenaing party is not obligated to pay professional rates for the considerable time required to comply. Although some states, for example, California, allow you to charge the subpoenaing party your usual and customary fee. States will usually have laws that set a nominal statutory witness fee for fact witnesses. And treating therapists are usually designated as fact witnesses as opposed to expert witnesses in terms of compensation. Psychologists who receive subpoenas by opposing counsel can petition the court to require payment of professional fees, but this usually requires the assistance of attorney, and what we've found is that the expenses involved often exceed what the psychologist could reasonably expect to recover. Now, even though the opposing party initiated your participation in the legal matter, your involvement is an indirect result of providing professional services to your client, and these services are not typically covered by health insurance. That being said, it's perfectly appropriate for a psychologist to bill clients for their professional time, provided that the client agreed to be responsible for that payment, which obviously requires, as I was mentioning, that you include a provision in your initial treatment agreement about this that is signed by the patient. The fee must be agreed upon in writing as part of that initial treatment contract. In other words, you can't later say when you receive a subpoena or are required to testify that you're going to bill the client for your time, as that's likely to result in a pretty frustrated client and maybe even a licensing board complaint. So related to these tips, the Trust has a number of templates and documents publicly available on our website, which you see at the bottom there, trustinsurance.com. One of the templates available for download is a sample informed consent agreement, and I've included some examples of relevant language here from that template. These example sections relate to the points I just made about your policies related to records requests, your willingness to even be involved in a legal matter. So the example provided here is related to working with a minor and parents agreeing not to involve the child's therapy records in any sort of custody matter. And then there is also sample language there related to fees for legal involvement. But you can see, as I said, the full template on the resources section of the Trust's website. Now let's say you've received a formal subpoena and now you need to figure out what to do. Here are some steps to consider. We're going to talk through how to figure out whether the subpoena is valid and what in fact the subpoena is requesting of you. Contacting the client is an important piece of this, and then considering whether you need to contact the requesting attorney or the court, and then finally whether you're going to challenge the subpoena or comply with it. Now, these steps may not necessarily happen in this order, although working through steps 1, 2, and 3 should always come first. So let's talk through those. In most cases, subpoenas are issued by an attorney involved in the case, as attorneys are considered officers of the court. Self-represented parties to a legal action can obtain a subpoena from the clerk of the court by filling out a subpoena form, and then in those cases, the subpoena is reviewed and signed by a judge or another court officer before being returned to the party requesting it. The subpoena then has to be served on the recipient according to the rules of the court. So each state has specific subpoena forms that are used in the jurisdiction where that case is taking place. A subpoena form can often be obtained from the clerk of the court, and many states make them available online through their court website. The subpoena form can be filled out by hand, including all of the required information, and the information might vary slightly between jurisdictions, but it typically includes things like the identity of the court in which the case is pending, the case title and case number, the name of the party from whom information is sought, what information is being requested, and the date, time, and location at which the information must be produced or where the individual must appear to testify. So obtaining and filling out a subpoena can be done by lay individuals, as I mentioned, or self-represented parties, but it can be a complicated process that has to be done correctly in order for this subpoena to be considered valid. In those cases, many people will choose to seek the advice or services of an attorney to ensure that the subpoena process was accomplished within the bounds of the law. So assuming the requesting party has completed the proper subpoena forms, you next have to figure out whether the subpoena is valid. Because if a demand is not legally enforceable for any reason, then the psychologist has no legal obligation to comply with it and may not even have a legal obligation to respond. One of the questions for this validity question, piece of this is whether it was outside of the jurisdiction. The court issuing the subpoena may not have jurisdiction over a psychologist or his or her records if they're from another jurisdiction. So for example, a subpoena issued in one state may not be legally binding on a psychologist living and working in a different state. So the jurisdiction question is a piece of this. Next, a subpoena to produce documents generally must allow sufficient time to respond to the demand and provide for some time for the opposing side to move to quash the demand. Without that allowed time period, the subpoena may not be valid. And then finally, proper service. So for example, some states may require service in person or by certified mail. In most states, fax is not an acceptable form of service. So before making this type of judgment about whether service was proper, we recommend that you consult with a local attorney. And part of the reason for that is it's often not a legal battle worth us as the clinician fighting if the subpoena seems otherwise valid. Because as a piece of that, there are ways to require the requesting party to perfect the subpoena or correct the aspects of it that compromise its validity. So whether or not the subpoena is valid is the first piece of this. Next, you need to understand what the document is requesting of you. Subpoenas often seem to be asking you to testify in person when in fact they are just seeking documents. So it's important to read the document carefully, as the legal language can often be confusing, and make sure you're determining what specifically is being requested, as well as some of these other details, like who are you supposed to deliver documents to, where and when are you supposed to appear to testify, and are you clear about the due date for these requirements? The next and probably most important step is to contact your client whose records are being requested. You need to tell your client exactly what you've been asked to turn over and that there is no guarantee that the information will be kept confidential. Once the privilege is waived, you can't take that back. So if the client says yes, that you can provide the requested information, then obtain the client's consent in writing. In the release that you have your client sign, make sure you include the scope of information to be released, by whom, to whom, for what purposes, over what period of time, and make sure that it's signed and dated by someone legally authorized to consent. Sometimes there are situations where verbal consent can be sufficient because of serious time constraints, but again, we'd encourage you to document that carefully in the client's records and, when possible, follow up by still obtaining that signed release. If a client says no, that he or she does not want the information released, then you have a couple options. You can talk with his or her attorney to determine whether the client's attorney will file a motion to quash. You can challenge the subpoena. We'll talk more about both of those options in just a few minutes. Or you can respond generically along the lines of this sample language I've provided. So, for example, sending a letter along the lines of, I can't confirm or deny providing services to this individual. My records are privileged and confidential. I would need a client's authorization or court order to release my records. Remember that even if the client's attorney indicates that he or she's going to challenge the subpoena, you still likely have an obligation to respond within the specified time period, which can be a generic response like the one I just read. Or it can be a response that indicates that you have been advised by opposing counsel that a motion to quash is going to be filed to challenge the subpoena. Both of those are still responses within the required time period. Now, there are a couple other things to remember that I just want to put on your radar. Remember that the client owns the privilege. Clinicians cannot demand confidentiality or privilege if the client has agreed to disclosure. You can and should talk to the client and perhaps his or her attorney about your role as a helping professional and explain how being compelled to testify as a witness could potentially compromise your ability to continue to provide treatment services. But it is ultimately up to the client in consultation with his or her attorney. Another thing to be aware of is that there are also instances in which the client might want to preserve her privilege, but is deemed to have waived her right to privilege, such as when a client introduces confidential information into the hearing herself, so talked about her therapy in the hearing, if the client is suing her clinician, or if the client has made her mental health a central component of the case, which, you know, for example, we see in criminal responsibility or insanity defense cases. And these are some other considerations I want on your radar. There are some differences we see across states, and so it's important to be familiar with your specific state's requirements when it comes to subpoenas. So, for example, in California, they have what are called notice to consumer forms. This process imposes on the requesting party an obligation to ensure that the client has been notified about the records request and gives them a specific time period for the client to object, or the clinician must provide the records. There are also states where minors can consent to their own treatment, and so with that, some states then have independent privilege rights for minors. So if it's unclear who has the authority to consent to the release of information in your situation or in your state, we encourage you to get further consultation from a local attorney or your professional liability insurer. When a client is struggling to decide whether to authorize the release of records, you can offer to have the client review records first. This can help the client and his attorney have a sense of what type of information is included in order to decide whether they want to disclose the information or not. In terms of treatment summaries, so we get this question a lot. When psychologists receive information requests, they often consider offering a summary of the record instead because they're trying to protect their patient's privacy at least to some degree. This is actually not a great strategy, though, because attorneys are rarely going to be satisfied with a prepared summary. They usually want to examine the exact contents of the records to see how they can use it to their advantage and to prepare for its use by their opponents. More importantly, opposing attorneys are likely to believe that the material was edited in ways that might reflect the bias of the clinician in favor of that client and then interfere with their best legal arguments. It's likely that you would eventually have to turn over the contents of the entire record anyway, at which point the opposing attorney may then try to discredit your testimony by pointing out all these discrepancies and omissions between your treatment summary and the original full record. So there are instances where providing a treatment summary can actually put you at more risk than simply providing the entire record as requested and with the client's consent, of course. Finally, there are important clinical considerations when records are requested for a current or ongoing client. The potential impact on the therapeutic relationship is very important to discuss with your client to make sure they understand that your participation in their legal matter could impact your work together. So, for example, the client might feel betrayed by information that you had to reveal or the way you answered a question on the stand about his current functioning or symptoms. So that's just another important piece to keep in mind. Now, there are situations that may necessitate you talking with attorneys, so I just want to review those a bit. When an attorney calls to request records or notify you that a request is coming, it can be unsettling or catch us off guard. So it's helpful to have a standard procedure in place for dealing with this type of contact. The questions you see on the slides are some examples of clarifying questions you might ask without breaching your client's confidentiality, right? You're not even acknowledging in these questions that you know this individual. In many cases, there is really no reason for you to be talking to the attorneys as opposed to talking directly with your client. But if you can't get a hold of the client, this could be a helpful next step in terms of trying to get some clarity around the nature of the request or the subpoena. During these initial contacts with an attorney, you don't need to provide any information, make any commitments, or even confirm that the person referred to is your client. As I mentioned before, in fact, you can't in most cases without a signed release. In some situations, particularly when the client's attorney is the requesting party, you may also be able to get updated contact information for the client if you need it and you've been having a hard time getting a hold of the client. And again, if the requesting attorney is your client's attorney, remember that they may just want to review the information right now to make a decision about whether to introduce the information into the discovery process in the case. You'd still need a release to speak with the client's attorney, and then you can find out whether the client's attorney intends to oppose or seek to limit the scope of that subpoena. A final note here, be careful with third-party record retrieval companies. So sometimes, you know, attorneys for cases that have lots of documents involved will hire these third-party record retrieval companies to seek out, you know, send the subpoenas, serve them, and seek out the records. But for your purposes, remember that they're not a party to the case. They're not likely able to provide you any helpful information, and so you should especially not be providing any confidential client information to the representative for any of those third-party record retrieval companies. So in addition to contacting the requesting attorney, I mentioned in the beginning that there are some situations where you might also need to contact the court. These are sometimes situations that come up or requests that might necessitate you to reach out to the court for guidance. This can come up when, for example, the court was your client. So we see this in court-ordered treatment evaluation cases where maybe you receive a records request or a subpoena from one of the parties, but in fact the court was your client. And so that's who you need to get clarification or permission from. In situations where the requesting attorney disagrees with your assertion that you cannot disclose the information and insists that you do so, you may want to seek guidance from the court. You or your attorney can call the court, explaining that you want to comply with the law, but that you are ethically obligated not to disclose confidential information, including whether someone is a client of yours, unless you have the client's consent or are ordered to do so by the court. You could then ask for guidance and be sure to confirm any guidance that you receive in writing, with copies, of course, to both attorneys. If you can't reach the court by phone, you can send the request for clarification in writing. Another piece to consider here is that there are times when you might want to seek limitation. So sometimes when a clinician is compelled to disclose information or testify, there are ways to minimize harm from disclosure. In these cases, you can request what's called an in-camera review, and I'll talk more about that in a bit. You can request to restrict the scope of questioning to topics that are most relevant, so the minimum necessary information. You can request limitations to who is present at the hearing, request to prohibit media coverage. One limitation you might request is to allow you to submit a summary rather than the whole file, or limit disclosure to only those parts of the file that are directly relevant to the case. So this is different than the cautions I was just saying a minute ago, where you're providing a treatment summary to the attorneys. If the court is the one ordering you to provide the treatment summary, there's less risk there in you being accused of having bias or something along those lines. Now, when you submit these requests for limitation to the court in making a decision is trying to balance the client's right to privacy, the public's right to know, and the defendant or respondent's right to a fair trial. If the request that you receive is overly burdensome, so for example, it would take you an inordinate amount of time away from your practice to comply with the request, you can also consider filing a motion with the court to deny or limit the demand because it is unduly burdensome. Now, in the case where the court orders you to testify, you can and should state for the record your ethical obligation to obtain consent, which the client is not willing to provide in this case. If the judge still orders you to testify, you can provide such testimony or you can refuse, but be aware that such refusal can result in your being held in contempt of court or being subject to other sanctions. So in that case, it's typically wiser to obey the court after appropriately informing the judge about your ethical responsibilities and how complying with the court's request places you in violation of those responsibilities. And you see there an example of some language you might use to state for the record your ethical obligation, but your ultimate, you know, willingness to comply given the court's order. So we already discussed asserting privilege on behalf of the client, right? By providing a generic response that does not confirm your relationship with the client, but does indeed assert privilege. Now, I also mentioned a while ago the option of filing a motion to quash, so I just want to talk through that a bit. A motion to quash is a formal request to the court that the subpoena be declared invalid or otherwise without legal force. If the client has refused to authorize you to disclose the information, the client's attorney might file this motion, which would relieve you of having to pay the costs related to filing the motion yourself. We've talked about the possibility of talking directly with your client's attorney with the appropriate signed releases to do so, to determine next steps. But do keep in mind that your client's attorney does not represent you. And so there may be situations in which you and your interests and the client's interests may differ. So for example, if the client wants the records released, but you have serious concerns about potential harm in doing so, that's often the case we see in high conflict child custody matters. And the responsibility to respond within the designated time frame is ultimately on you. So even if the client's attorney has indicated that he or she's going to file a motion to quash, but they fail to do so in a timely manner, you might be on the hook for failing to respond. So while working with the client's attorney, be sure to stay aware of your own legal obligations and deadlines. Now, let's say you've made the determination that you need to file a motion to quash. You typically want to work with an attorney to be sure that you are filing according to the appropriate procedures. In filing such a motion, you would explain to the court why protection of your client's confidential information is critical to maintain the integrity of the therapeutic relationship. It might be useful to present an argument concerning why the need to protect the information is more important than the need to disclose the information. If you can make a strong case about the harm or detriment caused by the disclosure, then that argument might outweigh the value of disclosing the information, or at the very least, disclosing it in the manner that's being requested by the attorney. If the court agrees with your argument, then you may not have to disclose any information. Now, in terms of protective orders, there are also instances in which you feel like you might need to file a protective order. So if you're worried about potential harm to the client or others, again, that comes up often in child custody matters where you have a therapist treating a child and the parents want to bring that child's therapy information into the custody matter. But the clinician, you know, is really concerned about that might compromise their therapeutic relationship or the child feeling safe in that space and so on. Another instance where this comes up is in order to protect test publishers and the integrity of test materials when a subpoena includes specific reference to the clinician having to turn over all testing materials. So in filing such a protective order, this is where the court would limit what information you need to share, or may agree to do what's called an in-camera review, which means in private, in order to determine whether the information should then be shared in public court. If the court orders you to provide the requested information, you can state for the court record that you have an ethical obligation to maintain the confidentiality of the communication, but that you are providing it in accordance with the court's order. Before you decide whether to personally challenge a subpoena, right, which is different than asserting privilege on behalf of the client, I just encourage you to think carefully about the costs, benefits, and various outcomes for both disclosure and non-disclosure. In some cases, you may actually be relieved to receive a court order because it takes the burden off you to decide whether to disclose. But if you do plan to challenge any legally compelled disclosures, you should work with your own attorney to do so, as there are specific processes and regulations related to filing motions to quash, related to communicating directly with the court to express concern, and so on. Assuming that there are not challenges to assert, here are some additional considerations related to complying with the subpoena. Make sure you're providing only the information requested, and even that might be negotiable. Often the request can be really extremely broad template language that, you know, will ask for everything under the sun, which may or may not apply to you, and you may be able to negotiate limitations, or the client's attorney can do so. In terms of limitations, I won't go into this aspect in detail as it can be pretty state specific, but just a few things I want on your radar. Some states have specific provisions that protect a clinician's separate psychotherapy notes from these legal demands for records. However, there are situations where attorneys might explicitly include psychotherapy notes in the request, in which case it can become a pretty nuanced legal analysis that would likely benefit from involving a local attorney. There are also instances in which raw test data and/or test materials are requested, as I mentioned a second ago, which then would also include some state-specific legal analyses regarding what is and is not permissible to provide as it relates to both raw test data and test materials. So just a brief note about test materials. It's important for you to distinguish between a request for test data versus copyright considerations when it comes to test materials, right? Like a question book or different stimuli for a particular validated test. Sometimes what the compromise that you can strike is that you're allowed to provide this to another qualified professional who can interpret or use those test materials rather than compromising the integrity of the test by releasing it, you know, in a public forum. The last consideration here under complying with a subpoena is just to go back and talk through a couple aspects related to depositions. As I described a bit earlier, depositions are unique situations in which the psychologist's testimony is part of the discovery process. Each side is allowed to discover what evidence that other side will be presenting to better, you know, be able to prepare for or refute that information. The attorney for the person opposing your client wants to find out from you at that deposition what you would say if you were called to testify in court. Depositions are taken outside the presence of a judge, so some lawyers will take liberties in their questioning or comments that they would not take in a trial. They might be unusually aggressive or offensive to discern how far they can push you. Now, the client's attorney is usually present there, but they'll typically remain silent because they're saving their questions for trials because they don't want to expose their strategy in advance. And so because of that, depositions can be the most difficult part of your involvement in the legal process, as it can be really damaging to the treatment relationship and pretty darn intimidating to be on the other side of that. And so because of that, some liability policies, including the trusts, will pay for an attorney to be present at a deposition to represent your interests and to assist you in avoiding any unnecessary negative outcomes from an already pretty tense situation. So one other thing I just want to talk through is that there are some nuances that come up in some of these specific settings I've highlighted here. Now, addressing the nuances of each of these specific settings goes beyond the scope of this webinar today, but it is important to note that there are different laws, regulations, and policies that apply in various settings, such as these that I've listed here. Those can include federal laws. So, for example, in education settings, you have to consider FERPA and how that impacts the records request you've received. There are state regulations that can impact these different settings, internal policies. So, for example, in correctional facilities, or forensic contexts. So just be aware that there are some specific settings that might have a bit of a different process or some different considerations when it comes to legal requests for records. So now we've talked through a bunch of different pointers, and I want to just briefly for a couple minutes go through a case example before we shift into some questions and answers. So Dr. Naive receives a phone call from an attorney who tells her that he is going to be sending over a subpoena for all of her records on her client, Mr. Sad. He tells her that Mr. Sad has waived his privilege by introducing his mental health into litigation, that the subpoena is mandatory for Dr. Naive, and that if Dr. Naive fails to comply, she will be in contempt of court and could be subject to fines or imprisonment. What should Dr. Naive do? Now, one of the first things, well, now that Dr. Naive has gone through this webinar, she knows exactly what to do, right? So the first thing for her to think about is the subpoena valid, right? But wait a minute, let's rewind. Dr. Naive hasn't even received a subpoena yet. She simply had an attorney call her and tell her that one was coming. So she may or may not ever receive that subpoena. So that's important for her to be aware that this could have been a pretty intimidating or threatening phone call, but there isn't in fact anything she needs to do now, except potentially let the client know that she received this phone call, and just to maybe preemptively or proactively talk through what the client would want her to do if she received that subpoena. Now, if and when she does receive the subpoena, then she's going to have to figure out, is the subpoena valid? And what specifically is being requested of her? Then, of course, she would contact her client to talk through whether the client wants her to release those records or not, what concerns might be present, again, thinking through some of those things we talked about, like, is this a current client? If so, how could this impact the treatment relationship? Again, Dr. Naive wants to be really careful not to be giving any legal advice, but just to talk through, here are some things for the client to think about with his or her attorney. If the client is comfortable with her providing the information that was requested, then she would need to have the client sign a release, and she could go ahead and provide that information, assuming she doesn't have any other sort of concerns about risk of harm in doing so. If the client is not comfortable with her providing the information, then she would likely just submit a generic response, like we talked about, asserting privilege, but not even acknowledging working with the client. Or if the client's attorney indicates that he or she will be filing a motion to quash, then Dr. Naive can respond accordingly. If there is confusion about what's being requested, about whether this is a court order or a subpoena, or any of those other aspects we talked about, then she could contact the court. And then finally, she'll just be carrying through, either challenging the subpoena, according to the ways we discussed, or complying. So just our sort of final takeaways, remember that subpoenas require a response, but not necessarily compliance. Remember that your role is usually to try and carry out the client's wishes, but there may be some situations where you have some concerns. That in that case, it's important to talk through with the client and to consider whether it's necessary for you to personally challenge a subpoena, in which case, again, we'd recommend you work with a local attorney to do so. And of course, when in doubt, consult, consult, consult. So do that with a local attorney, with your professional liability insurer. So Dr. Jana Martin mentioned at the beginning that we have the Trust Risk Management Advocate Program, where you can call for these free 20-minute consultations, where we will be able to talk through with you the specifics of your state requirements, the specifics of your case, and help you think through what makes the most sense as the next step. And in addition, some state psychological associations often as well have representatives that you can ask some of these questions to. Okay, so the last bit there are some references and resources I've provided for you, some great articles and resources on just how to think through some of these aspects we've been discussing today.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Zelichowski, for an extremely excellent and very comprehensive presentation. As you can imagine, the questions have been flooding in. Fortunately, we don't have a great deal of time to answer them, but let me start with a few that I'll try and summarize as best I can. And I guess one of the ones that a number of participants asked was, what is best practice when you are anticipating that there might be legal action? Say if you are involved from the outset in a high dispute custody evaluation, what is best practice for informed consent or before initiation of treatment to advise patients or clients about your ability to respond to subpoenas or other court actions? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it comes up a lot for us. So when you're working with high conflict families, I mean, some of the things I talked about, including, you know, prior to, including in your informed consent form, apply across the board, but apply especially, you know, in these cases of high conflict families where you do want to talk about these things at the outset. And I mentioned that sample informed consent form. It includes a whole child addendum, right? So when you're working with a child, there's language in there that starts to form what we'll often refer to as a parent agreement. So essentially, you and the parents are negotiating together, you know, here's what we all agree to, that, you know, you're in the midst of this high conflict matter, and we all agree that it's in the best interest of your child to protect this therapy space because you want your child to feel comfortable and, you know, be able to work through these issues. But if I and your child know that there's a likelihood you're going to drag their records or this disclosures that they've made right into court, then it's not going to be the most effective treatment. So you can talk that through with parents and, you know, in many cases have them all agree together to not do that, right? Essentially to keep the child's therapy out of the custody matter as much as possible. And they're essentially signing a contract, agreeing to that. Now, it's not that that contract necessarily holds any weight or is binding in a court of law, but if later one of the parents sort of changes their mind and is now demanding those records, you can go back and remind all the parties. Now, remember in the beginning, we all agreed that this was in the best interest of your child to protect this. You could show that agreement to the judge, you know, as part of his or her decision and ruling on whether to order you to provide the records. So there are things like that you can do at the front end to just be very clear and transparent, particularly also about those things I was mentioning related to fees. I mean, that can be a deterrent for some families in itself, knowing that you're going to charge for any and all time that you are, you know, required to be involved in their legal matter.
So the next question that a number of participants asked had to do with the length of time that might have elapsed between the termination of therapy and a request for a subpoena. Is there a standard length beyond which a psychologist would not be expected to respond to a subpoena? And a follow-on to that was, what in the case of a death of a patient or client who had not, prior to their demise, signed a release of information? Are there any particular considerations in those instances?
Okay, let me try to answer those separately. So the first one was time period elapsed from when you saw the client to when you can get a subpoena. Is that
correct?
Right? Okay. So it's not like a, I mean, there's statutes of limitations, of course, that apply to when a case can be filed. But some, for our perspective and for our role as the clinician, some of it has to do with, of course, the statutory period of time you're required to maintain records. So let's say in your state, you're only required to maintain records for a client for 7 years from the last date of service, or, you know, 3 years past the age of majority. If a long period of time has elapsed, you might not even have those records anymore. And so then that's what you could, you know, communicate. Again, not even confirming that this person was a client, but that you only maintain records, you know, for a certain period of time, and, you know, you no longer have records from the period of time that was referenced in the subpoena. So that would be how I'd probably handle those kinds of requests. Of course, if you still have the records, then they are still subject to that subpoena. So there's not any sort of time limit to when you can get a request. But as I mentioned, there are time limits to when a case can be filed, but that's not something you have to necessarily fight that battle.
I understand.
Now, the second, repeat the second question again, please.
In the case of a deceased patient or client who had not signed a release prior to their demise and a family member or others requests the records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in those cases, a lot of times what has to happen when you have a deceased client is that that family member has to be designated what's called the personal representative in most states. Some states call it an executor. And that is a formal legal designation where they go to probate court or family court or whatever the situation might be in your state and get that designation. They usually have to produce a death certificate and show that they are the appropriate next person. A lot of times, of course, that is the spouse or the adult child next of kin. But you can't just assume that just because somebody's calling saying they're a family member and saying that I am the executor of the state, in most states you are required to have that legal documentation of who is the personal representative, in which case that personal representative then takes over and is functionally the healthcare proxy, makes decisions about to whom records can be released just like the client would have. So that personal representative would then sign a release if they wanted you to send records to somebody else or something along those lines.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we have a number of other questions, but we are out of time. So I thank you again, Dr. Zelahusky.
My pleasure.
Excellent presentation.